Of the National League MVP award, becoming the first player to repeat since Barry Bonds won four in a row from 2001 to 2004. Pujols received all 32 first-place votes and 448 points in the balloting announced today by the Baseball Writers Association of America. It's the third MVP award for the St. Louis Cardinals star, who also won in 2005. He becomes the first unanimous MVP since Bonds in 2002. Illinois plays Wofford tonight in the second round of the Las Vegas Invitational Basketball Tournament. It's the first ever meeting between the 20th-ranked Illini and the Terriers, who belong to the Southern Conference. Bradley hosts Presbyterian in a game that's part of the same tournament. Today's college basketball schedule also includes Northwestern hosting Liberty, Chicago State hosting Eastern Illinois, Mississippi Valley State at St. Louis, and Chattanooga at Missouri. Number 6 Purdue defeated 9th-ranked Tennessee 73-72 in the championship game of the Paradise Jam last night in St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. Etuan Moore had 22 points for the Boilermakers and was named tournament MVP. Robbie Hummel scored 20. That's sports.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
Americans like seafood a lot, and as a result of overfishing, many species are disappearing. That's causing a ripple effect that's changing the patterns of sea creatures. For example, in the Chesapeake Bay, there is an invasion of stingrays. The cow-nose stingray is eating oysters raised there commercially. Some people say if you can't beat the invaders, eat them. Sabri Benishore has the story.
In a little boat just offshore of Virginia's Cone River, A.J. Erskine leans overboard. He's using 20-foot poles with gaping jaws full of long, needle-like teeth to scrape the bottom of the emerald-colored river. Up comes a pile of oysters. They're only about a year old.
We don't feel comfortable giving them any more than 1 year of a chance, you know?
That's because Erskine is worried about stingrays, specifically cow nose rays. Every March, the winged sea creatures migrate into the bay from the Atlantic. They come to give birth, mate, and eat.
What they do is flap their wings, put the oysters in a pile, and it starts to crunch the shells. They can stir up the water so much, you know, when they're in a school, and they go through those seabed oysters in a weekend.
Erskine says it's become a huge problem for oyster farmers. The rays also damage the underwater environment. They uproot aquatic grasses, destroying nurseries for fish and blue crabs. Some biologists believe there are more rays because a main predator, the shark, is being overfished out in the Atlantic. Tiger sharks in this area have declined 99% over the past 30 years. Other biologists say it's that strict limits on fishing in the Chesapeake Bay have meant fewer rays caught accidentally in giant nets. Whatever the reason, oyster farmers are looking for a way to control the rays. 100 miles inland, in Richmond, Mead Amory thinks he has a solution.
Depending on how you prepare it, it's delicious.
Avery is a seafood distributor. He and officials with the state of Virginia want you to try stingray.
The texture is wonderful. It has a veal, pork type of texture.
It's been a tough sell so far.
I mean, people immediately when they hear the word ray, I don't want to eat that.
Marketers are trying hard, though. They don't call it cow nose ray, but rather Chesapeake ray. They're pushing the ray in restaurants from Virginia to Japan. And it may take off. After all, lobsters used to be considered insects of the sea, and only the poor ate them. The popular Chilean sea bass used to be a nuisance bycatch. But while those cases offer hope for marketers, they carry warnings for environmentalists. Both sea bass and Maine lobsters were dangerously overfished because of their popularity. Bob Fisher is a biologist with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He knows full well there are risks involved in going after stingrays.
You remove something, especially a predator, one of the top predators like that, from the food chain, you know, we don't know what the repercussions would be.
He says stingrays are slow to mature and generally give birth to only one offspring at a time, and no one even knows how many there are. But Fisher is still very much open to the idea of harvesting the rays, given the problems they seem to be causing for oyster growers.
I look at things that are in our oceans as resources. Okay, it's our responsibility to take care of our resources. But it's also a resource that's there that can be, and I believe should be, utilized. for humans.
Fisher is working with the Marine Products Board and the Department of Agriculture to come up with a plan to strictly limit fishing of the ray to what's sustainable. So, if the whole thing is successful, you might find Chesapeake ray on a plate near you. For the Environment Report, I'm Sabri Benishore.
Many drivers will do their holiday traveling with the help of a GPS system, a device on the dashboard that locates your car on the map and provides directions to your destination. The companies that make these systems are looking for directions of their own. Cell phones offering GPS guidance seem likely to cut into the sales of companies like Garmin and TomTom. Here's NPR's Tamara Keith.
Cell phones have become the Swiss Army knives of electronic devices. They take pictures, play music, deliver email, and now increasingly they offer GPS navigation. And we're not just talking about a map that knows where you are. This is full-service, turn-by-turn directions. I took the new Droid smartphone out for a test drive with Melanie Ortel, a spokesperson for Verizon.
Take us to RFK Stadium.
Says it's getting driving directions.
Head northwest on Massachusetts Avenue Northwest toward 7th Street Northwest.
The Droid phone uses the new Google Maps navigation system. Ortel drives a lot, and she doesn't seem to have the best sense of direction. In a lot of ways, the Droid isn't all that different from standalone portable navigation devices or other smartphones with GPS capabilities.
Navigation systems on these devices are so helpful because no matter how far I'm driving, if I come across traffic, it helps me redirect, gives me other options route-wise for getting there. Or if I make a wrong turn, it redirects me immediately.
Droid's Google-based navigation system is totally free. There's no extra monthly service charge. So if you can get a good navigation system on your phone, why would you go out and spend $150 on a standalone GPS device? That seems to be what the market is wondering. Stock in Garmin is down 16% since Google announced its navigation app for the Droid. TomTom stock is off 32%. Steve Koenig is with the Consumer Electronics Association.
I think the writing is on the wall for the marketplace that apps, navigation apps for your smartphone are going to eat into a market opportunity for dedicated portable navigation devices.
Koenig says the standalone devices tend to have bigger displays than smartphones.
They're not quite to the same level of functionality and ease of use, so that's a ray of hope, at least for the short term, for portable navigation.
Not long ago, these devices were the darlings of consumer electronics. Sales volume doubled from 2007 to 2008. Now most expect sales will be flat at best. Tom Murray is the vice president of market development for TomTom. He says the Droid is raising some provocative questions for his industry, but he isn't convinced it will be a game changer.
I think that as the dust settles and people have time to appreciate what its impact is truly going to be to the category, I think that, you know, different perspectives perhaps will prevail.
And there's one other thing these companies are counting on. Not everyone will want to use their phone to get driving directions. Jessica Myers is with Garmin International.
We still think both will exist because you have people that want an all-in-one device that does it all, and then you have people that are more interested in having devices that do one thing extremely well.
After all, Swiss Army knives haven't put corkscrew makers out of business, and cell phones that take pictures haven't killed the digital camera industry. Frank Dixon says the pressure is on for Garmin and TomTom.
It's going to force those other devices to get that much better.
Dixon is vice president of research with the firm Instat.
It's got to be a whole lot better if I'm going to spend that much money. And so it's going to force them to innovate.
Because the competition has arrived.
In 1/4 mile, you will arrive at your destination.
Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
You have arrived.
We have arrived. Thanksgiving is a time when Americans give thanks for what's good in their lives. Sometimes good things are unexpected. In the western Illinois town of Monmouth, something good came out of an act of vandalism. Rich Egger explains.
The story begins in 2008. Taggers were leaving their mark on a number of buildings in town. Residents were getting angry. Then the group tagged the Buchanan Center for the Arts. The center's new director, Susan Toomey, did not get angry Instead, she took a different approach.
So I wrote an open letter to them and taped it to the side of our building and told them that I appreciated their use of color and form and that I thought that, you know, they had enough creative talent that we could do something more constructive. And if they were interested, to come and see me.
And they did.
Yes, they did. They
didn't suspect this was a setup by the police or anything.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. I mean, they could have. I mean, I've told them subsequently that I'm so proud of them. I mean, it took a real leap of faith on their part to come in and talk to me because they had no idea what they were walking into. And there were three kind of, you know, scruffy-looking kids standing in the front door saying, "Are you Susan?" And I said, "Yes. Are you the Two-Wheeled Mafia?"
One of those scruffy-looking kids is Bobby Hall. He was home when someone stopped by and told him about the note at the art center.
I was like, "Well, that's kind of funny. Let's go up and look at it." And it asked us to come in. We were kind of suspicious on whether it was, you know, just like a trap, you know, see if we'd come in and get us arrested or not. And figured, you know, what the hell, go for a shot. Went in and it was legit.
Susan Toomey nicknamed the kids the Lost Boys. She says she knew right away they were good kids. She says they simply needed some guidance and attention. Toomey suggests that they create a mural on one of the art center's outside walls.
They asked me very sweetly about Broke My Heart. They said, "Gosh, do you have a theme you'd like us to follow?"
What they settled on was a distorted city landscape of Monmouth. It's done in graffiti style. Part of it is in shades of gray. There are two big spray cans on either side of the illustration's buildings.
And as the spray comes out of the cans and hits the buildings, it becomes colored. So those parts of the mural are in color, and the rest of it's black and white.
A couple of the Lost Boys moved on, but Bobby Hall stuck around. He's working on the mural with Tiffany Davis. She's known Hall for years. Davis thinks it's cool to have their work displayed in a public place.
A wall that you walk by every day and you wish that you could just put graffiti all over, but you never had the chance to.
Do you see a lot of walls in town that look like blank canvases to you?
Oh, yeah. I see them all the time.
This wall is in a walkway between the art center and the library. A lot of people come through here. One such person is Daniel Jacobson of Monmouth.
It's nice to see that instead of using their graffiti ability to go out and spray the heck out of something, you know, and make it look terrible, that they're taking and they're beautifying part of the city with it.
What Bobby Hall likes about graffiti art is that you cannot simply pick up a wall and take it someplace else.
It brings people to it, more or less. You can't just pass it around like a note. They have to come to it and look at it, which in turn makes them want to see others. And it also helps them get outside. We're fighting obesity too.
So. I didn't know graffiti could cure all of society's ills, but
it's anything is possible when you have spray paint.
And Susan Toomey feels anything is possible with art in general. She considers it a vehicle for change. That's certainly been the case here. Bobby Hall now holds down a full-time job at Alexis Fire Equipment. He hopes to start taking some college classes to work on his painting technique. Hall doubts he would have considered doing that if he had not gotten involved with the art center.
Probably wouldn't have, no. I'd probably be in jail.
The mural remains a work in progress. Hall and Davis are both busy, Hall with his job and Davis with classes at Monmouth College. Plus, materials are not always easy to come by, though some businesses have donated paint and other supplies. No matter how the mural ends up, Susan Toomey is happy with the way things worked out. Does she have any closing thoughts?
No, just if they ever hear the story, just so they know how proud I am of them.
Apparently, the feeling is mutual. Remember the typewritten note, the one that encouraged the Lost Boys of Monmouth to put their talents to better use? Bobby Hall says he still has it, folded up and kept in his room. Rich Egger reporting.
When someone wishes you a happy Thanksgiving, consider what has made any Thanksgiving a happy one. Commentator Amy Guida did, and she's decided it all depends on the decade. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
There's something really special about Thanksgiving. Maybe it's the pop-up button turkey, the stuffing fresh from a crinkly bag, or the pumpkin pie filling straight from the can. Maybe it's the fun family time spent poring over big box store ads with sugar plum dreams about the next day's sales on plasmas. Or maybe it's those little brown turkeys drawn from the feather-fingered hand of a store clerk tasked with decorating. If those images don't put you in the holiday spirit, perhaps you're not the newfangled Thanksgiving type and long for a return to the olden days of Thanksgiving. If so, you'd better decide with precision just how olden the days should be, because the Thanksgiving holiday has meant different things at different times in U.S. history. It's true that I'm no Thanksgiving expert. I prefer steak to poultry in late November. But I've studied the earliest court decisions that mention such a holiday, and it's clear from those that uniformity in celebration has been far from uniform over the years. In the earliest mentions of Thanksgiving by courts, Thanksgiving is spelled with a lowercase t because it seems any day could be identified by a particular state's governor as one for Thanksgiving. On any Thanksgiving day, in Connecticut in 1825 at least, there could be no servile labor or recreation, which means that the Detroit Lions could indeed have played football that day because the players do no work and no one enjoys it. Back then, one of the lawyers in the case described a day of Thanksgiving as one in which the good people of the state would withdraw from worldly cares and labors and secure the observance of public worship. One of those early courts, for example, found a writ served on a public official on Thanksgiving void because no one was supposed to be working that day. As for the public worship part, a court in 1830 looked back a few years before to a time when those who failed to show up for public service on Thanksgiving days would be fined 5 shillings. The statute was later amended, the court noted with some satisfaction, to fine only those who didn't show up to public worship for a period of 3 months. But by 1860, a federal court in Massachusetts classified the fasting and prayer on any Thanksgiving day as entirely voluntary, explaining that Thanksgiving was but an excellent custom that bound no man's conscience or required him to abstain from labor. And within several years, several courts had found that while the government could prohibit work on Sundays, Thanksgiving Day was an entirely different matter, and that even courts could go about their business on that day. This is not to say that Thanksgiving wasn't celebrated in some form in late November by that time. In 1890, one court reminisced that Thanksgiving had been proclaimed a November holiday for as long as the present generation could remember. But it's had decidedly varied significance over the years. And that means that those olden days people could very well relate to our newest Thanksgiving trend, online shopping on Thanksgiving Day to beat the Black Friday rush. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky.
Today, an experiment to see how butterflies develop in space.
We selected